Hi, I'm Robert Brown.
And I'm Ian Heisler.
And you're listening to In the Margin, a reading-based podcast where we discuss Christian civic engagement and public witness.
In each episode, we will consider the contributions of various authors to an ongoing conversation about how the church can love, serve, and speak grace and truth to its neighbors.
With the help of these authors, we want to ask, what does it mean for Christians to be here? What should it look like to be in the world, yet not of the world? How are we to live, read, and converse in the margin?
On today's episode, we will be discussing an article by Gary Saul Morson called The Problem with Happiness. And we'll also be discussing Leo Tolstoy's classic short story slash novella, The Death of Ivan Illich. Morson's article is dealing with themes of happiness in a few different Russian novelists and thinkers, including Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And so we thought pairing it with one of Tolstoy's actual stories might be a helpful complement.
Death of Ivan Illich by Leo Tolstoy is one of my favorite pieces of fiction. And so when I came across Morson's article, it just made sense, at least as a pretense, for us to discuss some fiction on the podcast.
Yeah.
And what this has to do with civic engagement, hopefully over time will become more clear. We'll see where it goes. Just provisionally, let's just say that a working thesis, I think this is part of Morson's thesis, that a society where everybody is bent on their main goal is happiness will ultimately lead to societal decay. Then nobody's going to be making sacrifices. Nobody's going to be willing to risk unhappiness.
A large portion of his article is pointing out how specifically Solzhenitsyn makes it explicit, but some of Dostoevsky's thinking kind of underlines this too. Just the idea of the kind of materialistic philosophy that was undergirding a lot of the USSR's kind of socialism. So in that way, it sort of directly relates to government and political systems and things like that.
Morson makes the argument that Bolshevism and Epicureanism are actually cousins. This one individual's hedonistic quest for pleasure, above all else, may not necessarily seem like a collectivist totalitarian ideology. They might seem like they're totally different, but actually both of them are very materialistic.
Right.
Bolshevism is Epicureanism turned into a system of government.
Epicureanism is sort of underlying it philosophically, yeah. And he's getting a lot of that from Dostoevsky and from Solzhenitsyn in particular.
And let's give a bit of information about Morson himself. So Gary Saul Morson, Wikipedia styles him as an American literary critic and Slavist. So he's very familiar with Slavic literature. I've come across his name before, particularly if you read about Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, or my favorites, the literary theorist Mikhail Bakhtin, you're going to come across Morson a few times, often in the U.S. One of the foremost scholars on Russian literature is Morson, and so he's writing this piece in the Athenian Review, and again he's synthesizing a lot of his reading in Russian literature to see what they have to say about happiness and how does that relate to us today.
I didn't really get a super clear sense that he was necessarily trying to make any huge point like that was original to him. He's just kind of trying to like highlight this point that all three of these guys are also they're making.
And he's
together.
Responding to contemporary things where more and more the sciences and even in forms of governing, what he begins with is that more and more people are trying to figure out what is the science of happiness? How could we pursue happiness? What is happiness? What is it exactly? How could we maximize it? He's even looking at how there definitely is something true to the fact that a country's happiness does not correlate with their GDP or
with
their wealth.
Right.
There has to be something more than just accruing things in your possessions or even your healthcare or how uncorrupt your government is, etc. Like those things all might contribute to it, but it has to be more than that. But the UN, what was the name of the? They have some sort of like index.
The happiness index. I literally think it's called the happiness index.
Which is really weird, and
it
seems just rather silly to think that we could put a number on how happy a country is. Countries,
let alone
sentient beings, they are collections of people.
It's like maybe you could do that for a person, I don't even feel like you could really do that for one person, but let alone for a country. Like,
yeah.
That's just...
Yeah.
It's kind of silly. Like, I don't know who actually takes that seriously. Maybe, I don't know. The way that he's talking about it, it sounds like a lot of people actually look at it as like, oh, this is like a meaningful, like, measurement of, like, how well this country is doing. It's like, really?
I mean, the one, again, I think I do... I'm aware that there have been some scholars and people doing working in global development that have been trying to push away from just focusing solely on gross domestic product and trying to get a more holistic understanding of human flourishing. So there seems to be a good impulse there to, let's not just go by how much we're producing or life expectancy or wages or level of government corruption, etc.
At least those things are like measurable, though.
Well, one of the measurements was perceptions of government corruption. So it's kind of a subjective thing.
Yeah, it's like, how do you measure that on like a national scale?
I mean, even if it wasn't perceptions, how would you measure government corruption? Like,
yeah.
How many of these people have taken a bribe? That they will admit to.
Right.
And how many bribes do they take? How would you quantify that? And so I think it is really odd that we're at a point now where, well, it's great that, again, we're not just thinking about his economics.
You could
be in the wealthiest country in the world and still be miserable. So that's, I mean, it's good that we're trying to be a little bit more holistic about that. But to try to put a number on happiness seems like a fool's errand. Could be extremely misleading.
I think that's actually true. Like, there's a lot of really wealthy countries that have, you know, really high, like, suicide rates and things like that. That is maybe something to take away from it that is constructive. Like, oh, yeah, maybe we should try to measure a country's general well-being in other ways than just how much money it's making. But, I mean, measuring its happiness seems, like, kind of hard to do. But it is also, like, a pretty recent, well, comparatively speaking, recent interest that people have. I think what I found this to be helpful. It's not something I had really heard before, but I think it kind of makes sense with what I have heard about history. But he says, Morrison says that a commonplace of European intellectual history holds that during the Enlightenment, many Europeans started asking not, quote unquote, how can I be good or how can I be saved, but how can I be happy? If so, then happiness is the goal of life is a fact of Western modernity, not of human nature. So I think that's just kind of a helpful, like, keep things in perspective, kind of like cold splash of reality is like, yeah, maybe there's a lot of people who are asking this question now around the world. How can I be happy? How can I pursue happiness? How can I secure happiness in my life? But actually, this has started to be asked more as a kind of a central concern of life by Western Europe in the Enlightenment, like pretty recent and pretty like localized.
Yeah. And also he says that there could be some ethnocentrism or just in general, like, Western bias, and that's what every other culture wants, too. Like, every other culture is happiness-driven. That really, it could very well be the case that is not at all the case, where other countries, other cultures, they're focused on well-being or on security for their family, for leaving behind a legacy, for making sure that their community is stable, or maybe the focus is on family, or on honor. Or on virtue, even. And that sounds like a really quaint idea, that we're not trying to be happy, we're trying to be virtuous, or for Christians, trying to be holy.
Right.
Being holy instead of happy, which would lead to happiness, but as a sort of secondary benefit. That's a big point in Morrison's article, is that if you start doing seemingly selfless things, but the goal is still, I'm doing this so that I'll become more happy, that makes it selfish. So if happiness is still the main
thing.
And I'm not fully
Well, I think sure. He means like individual personal happiness, like my own happiness. If that kind of becomes the goal that you're trying to reach by doing virtuous things.
The main goal, I'm working the soup kitchen.
Quote unquote, so I can, selfless things. Then it's not really selfless if you're mainly just doing it for your own
happiness. Yeah, and I would absolutely agree with that. Happiness. Yeah, the only reason you're volunteering at the soup kitchen is so you can boost your own self-esteem, think of yourself as a healthy human being who's kind, or the only reason you gave away 20-30% of your paycheck is for the same reason, or you name it.
It's not really selfless.
And so I think that would be a problem. And one of his arguments, and I think this is definitely true, is that there are some things in life that we don't get by aiming at. There are things that we only get indirectly as a side effect, a good side effect.
I feel like that's something that C.S. Lewis says almost exactly in like Mere Christianity or maybe Abolition of Man.
Like aim at heaven and you get all the world thrown in. We talked about that in Mere Christianity. Right. Yeah.
And so I don't know if Morrison's necessarily explicitly saying this, but it seems like maybe one implication of what he's saying is that, yeah, happiness is good and, like, maybe natural to all human beings, like, to desire it, right? It's, like, something that everyone seems to want, but if we make it sort of our prime object in life, and that's kind of the thing that we're seeking and trying to achieve more than anything else, then we're probably not really going to get it, maybe. We're going to end up being just kind of, like, basically just Epicureans, where we're just sort of, like, seeking after pleasure and stuff like that. The thing that he kind of contrasts happiness to, I think, is, like, quote-unquote meaningfulness. So he uses that word a few times to, in contraposition. He says, if one aims for meaningfulness as a source of pleasure, one is aiming for pleasure, not meaningfulness. There are some things one cannot get by striving for them. So pleasure and happiness, I think he's kind of, like, associating those there. But yeah, like we're saying, it's like, maybe happiness is more of, like, a byproduct. It's not something that we should necessarily strive for the most out of anything else. There's another part that kind of relating to the, how has the question changed since the Enlightenment, right? So, like, before, mostly people were asking, how can I be good, or how can I be saved, or maybe how can I be pious, or something like that. There's, like, this part where he talks about, like, yeah, well, people are always asking this question of, like, how can I be happy, but one can imagine that being a weird question to, like, a lot of religious people, like Muslims or Jews or Christians or whatever. Like, maybe they're probably more concerned with asking, like, how can I be devout, or how can I be, you know, faithful or whatever. Like, he kind of puts that intention as well. Yeah, so happiness, basically, it's a pretty new, like, relatively speaking, compared to most of human history, it's a relatively new thing to make that sort of our chief goal. Though I guess, as he kind of goes on to talk about Epicureanism, maybe it's sort of like a revival of that sort of ancient philosophy there. But in terms of, like, how much it's being asked today, like, this whole, like, happiness index thing, and, like, a lot of sociologists or whoever he's quoting at the beginning, it's all pretty recent kind of preoccupation, I guess, for Westerners.
Yeah, and his point, when he's particularly looking at Russian history, particularly the history of the USSR and the way the Soviets would use torture or the gulag to punish dissidents, his point is that when we really start following that, it starts to break down. Put this kind of Epicurean view, put it under pressure, or take a person who's Epicurean, put them under intense pressure, and see if this still holds true.
Yeah.
He goes to the philosopher Robert Nozick, who talks about, well, what if I could just be a brain in a vat, and I just hit with, like, these different chemical bursts that will just keep my brain always stimulated and happy. And he said, well, most people would not want to live in that kind of experience machine, because what Nozick says is, would you plug it in? What else can matter to us other than how our lives feel from the inside? Nozick writes, we want to do certain things and not just have the experience of doing them. It is only because we first want to do the actions that we want the experiences of doing them or thinking we've done them. We want to be a certain sort of person, but someone floating in a tank is an indeterminate blob. There's no answer to the question of what such a person is like. Is he courageous, kind, intelligent, witty, loving? It's not merely that it's difficult to tell. There is no way that he is. Morrison is commenting that this would, based on what Nozick's saying, that this would limit us to only what man can make. That world inside the vat could only be as good as man could cook up. It would just already be limited to what humans think happiness is or what they know about it. If I'm only aware of five different ways to make the brain happy through various chemical stimulations, that's the only happiness you're going to get. I'm not aware of the other 155 varieties.
Right.
Experience.
Right.
And so we're not getting to grow. That one of Morrison's big points is that if we really want true meaningfulness, which would also have as a good side effect, happiness, we're going to have to go through hard things. There has to be risk. There has to be the chance of it not happening.
Right.
I think he's quoting Dostoevsky, which is comparing, like, two different kinds of execution. One is when you're on death row and it's certain, you're just going to die at some point. There's no way out. There's no way to appeal or anything.
That's right.
That is worse than all of a sudden just being ambushed in the woods and someone's trying to chop your head off. Because then until the very end, you're still hoping that somebody else is going to come in here, or I'm going to overthrow the enemy, I'm going to get out of this. Until the very end, there's still this adrenaline, and there's still, like, this dogged optimism, like, or this will to live that's still there. It's far worse to be sitting on death row with just the knowledge that it is going to happen, and there's no way out. So whenever there's possibility of things going well or going bad, that's when meaningfulness and happiness can be found, because the struggle is more valuable than the security.
Yeah, right. And that's a big... So that security is a thread that he's sort of weaving together through the three authors that he does draw from. So Dostoevsky, Solzhenitsyn, and Tolstoy. This kind of idea of happiness that's presented is more of this kind of like the brain in the tube thing, where it's like, oh yeah, just getting hit with different chemicals.
Right.
Like, it's a passive thing, and it's like experiential, and it's like depending on this secure state where you can just kind of like receive these things and be like content and stable and stuff. There's a part that I want to like quote that he's drawing from. I think it's one of Dostoevsky's stories. I want to say it's The Idiot, maybe. Dostoevsky argues that life, to be meaningful, must take place in a special kind of time. Our efforts must matter, which means that we must live into an uncertain future. Effort can make a difference only if the desired outcome is possible but not guaranteed. We value something only if we choose it and work for it. For lives to be meaningful, time must be open. More than one outcome must be possible. Meaning exists in a world with suspense, not in like this static and kind of fixed world, like the person who's on death row, right? Like that's already settled. Like they can't do anything about it. There's no like chance of their future to change. Their state is fixed. In a way, I mean, I don't think he's equating that exact situation with like people whose main goal is happiness, but I think he's saying that if this kind of like ideal happy state is your end goal, where it's like, I can just kind of sit down and be happy and content and be fine and stable and secure and all that, that's like actually a situation where happiness cannot be achieved, because you're passively receiving this situation. You're not in a place where your efforts matter, where they can change things, and where things are not like guaranteed to you. Mm-hmm. And so he kind of goes on to connect this to like socialism in the USSR, and how one of the goals was like establishing this like secure life where there are these guaranteed like good things for everybody. Basically, he's saying that Dostoevsky, and I think maybe later on he talks about how Solzhenitsyn criticizes the same thing, but he says definitely Dostoevsky's criticizing it. So here's another part where he's talking about what Dostoevsky says in relation to socialism. He says, for Dostoevsky, this is what socialists fail to understand. Intended as a blessing, socialism offers us a world of absolute security, and so takes away our humanness. In principle, its goal is that experience machine, which is the brain and the bat thing. Yeah. The UN calculators of happiness also presume that the more security, the better. The less insecurity, the more happiness points a society is awarded. So there's kind of this underlying belief, both with the socialists in the USSR, whom Dostoevsky is critiquing, and with the happiness index thing, the belief being that security equals happiness.
But, yeah, or that more of a good thing is even more of a good thing. Like, this mm-hmm. thing is good, but therefore let's get more of it. It right. Therefore lead to more good. It's not a curve or anything. It's just a straight line slope going upward. The X and Y are in a synchronous relationship, so that the more X, the more Y. And not that at some point you hit the tipping point where the curve or the line, the parabola, starts bending down. I'm picturing a graph, like an algebra graph.
So you're saying like the more security,
yeah.
Their idea is that the more security you have, therefore the more happiness you will have.
Yeah, I think there would be some point where I think we need at least some security. Like
right.
kids flourish in homes that are stable, and they know that there can be food on the table, and that mom and dad are still both going to be there, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But if you become a helicopter parent, your child's going to become very unhappy very quickly. They want some security. There, the line is going, as security grows, so does happiness. But if you start over-throttling on the security lever, the happiness is going to stall.
Right.
It's going to become unhappy.
Yeah, that's it. So that's kind of like brings up this interesting, which I feel like is, would be interesting to talk about with regard to just like non-socialistic governments, and I guess more, you know, like trying to just balance, right, like liberty and security, right? Like how much of one do you need? How much of the other do you need? Right. Like you kind of have to have both of them. How much then, you know, those exist in tension, but it's interesting. Like, I think what he's, what Morrison is saying, Dostoevsky talks about here, is basically that emphasis on security misses a big point, which, and the big point is that, like, actually there's a lot of happiness to be found outside the confines of, like, this secure life, right?
Right, right.
Like, Dostoevsky seems to be saying, like, actually that's, like, a lot of what makes us human is that we have to be able to, like, make efforts that can actually change things or affect things. That's part of what will bring us happiness, not just the security. So,
and that would lead really well into Ivan Illich. But just to kind of wrap things up a little bit, to wrap up the Morrison section of this talk, let's think about what Morrison's saying about how Epicureanism, it's modern, or one of the ways it has shown up in the modern world is in socialism. And he says, it might seem odd that a Bolshevik should be a Epicurean, but the novel, this is one of Solzhenitsyn's novels, the novel by Solzhenitsyn makes clear that these two forms of materialism share a common tenet. There are no values beyond the material world of here and now. Epicureanism applies this insight to the individual, so that the sole standard of good and evil is the individual's pleasure and pain. Bolshevism applies the same idea collectively. In Bolshevik ethics, as in Epicurean, all other standards but getting what one wants, and for Bolsheviks that would mean what the Communist Party wants, are illusions. And the big point Morrison makes in the latter part of his article, particularly as he's reading Solzhenitsyn, is that Epicureanism gets pushed to its extreme if it's turned into a governing principle for an entire people, an entire worldview, an entire system of government, an entire way of life. Once it is mass-produced as a dictate, where would it lead? And the trouble is just morality is vacated because it's just material.
Yeah, nothing really exists beyond the imminent world, the material world. He's saying that's part of what was underlying the brutality of like the Bolshevik and of like Stalin's regime, is that there's this belief by the people who are running that government that, yeah, like, morality doesn't matter. And I think he kind of zooms in on like how pity is seen as like, there's no reason for that. Showing that like is basically like giving in to thinking that no, there is actually something beyond the material world.
Yeah.
It's like, and no, we're not gonna think
and
that.
And when you make pleasure the aim, or even survival your aim, particularly if you were in one of the prisons or in the gulag, he says if you go to the right, you lose your life, and if you go to the left, you lose your conscience. So you could be willing to steal or kill or lie or cheat in prison to save your own skin, or you could try to be a decent person, live for something other than the material and your own immediate gratification.
And probably survival. Die.
And die, but you could die with a good conscience. And so you had to choose between life and conscience. Which would you rather have?
Mm.
This is how Morrison concludes his article. If we are to make our lives meaningful, we must live for values beyond happiness, values that may conflict with happiness. Sometimes suffering can be beneficial, not because it may make us capable of greater pleasures. So again, earlier thing, if we can't just aim at it. We can't just say, I'm going to suffer because it's going to make me happier.
Right.
But the reason we should is because it might deepen the soul. We must live and we must love, not just on this scrap of earth, not just in the here and now, not just for our pitiful selves, but for the world of good and evil, of truth and falsehood, and of the great values espoused in Russian literature. He's not making explicitly a Christian argument. I don't know if Morrison is Christian or not, but he's clearly really critical of the materialism of our age, whether it's in Russia or in America today. Some way or other, you need to find some sort of a higher value system that isn't just based on your temporary pleasure and happiness and contentment. Yeah. His article and The Death of Ivan Illich by Tolstoy really reminds me of one of my favorite books, which is John Piper's book, Don't Waste Your Life. I have the audiobook version, and I listen to it once a year ever since, like, by the time I graduated from high school. Just something good to just go back and review and see if I'm just self-evaluating. Am I wasting my life right now?
Did I waste my life this year? hopefully not.
And one of the big things in that book is Piper's argument that risk is right. He says, I want to explode the myth of safety. We think that things are safe, but we don't realize, you know, all around us, you could have a heart attack, you could get hit by a car, there could be a shooting, etc. There's so many different ways to die. And now in the West, we have diseases that come from excess. Other countries have to deal with problems like malnutrition. We have to deal with the opposite issues from having too much. And so he talks about how if we are going to make good use of our lives and not waste our lives, particularly as Christians, we're going to have to realize that God may ordain suffering for us. Really, I think the way to remember is that our ultimate security is in our eternal standing with God. So that we can be told in Scripture, that, you know, you will be executed, you'll be flogged, you will be beaten, and whatnot, but not a hair of your head will perish. So I could lose everything, but be securely within the grip of God.
Yeah.
He's saying, you know, Romans 8, who will separate us from the love of God? Show all these things. He lists all kinds of terrible things that could happen to you.
Material things.
He isn't, and it's not a hypothetical.
Yeah.
He's saying, through all these things, we are still more than conquerors. And so there is still security. We still need some sort of security, but the security is a transcendent security. It's not a material security. It's not in the here and now. And so if I know I have that security, I'll be willing to risk everything. And that's what the call to discipleship is going to require of us. You can think about Dietrich Bonhoeffer living under a similarly totalitarian regime as Solzhenitsyn. And he wrote The Cost of Discipleship and realized, well, I don't want to waste my life. Mm. I could just do the comfortable route and not stand up to the Nazi regime and stand against Hitler. I could save my own skin.
Right.
But he realized, well, costly grace requires costly obedience. And I think, to finally get to this wonderful piece of fiction that we're... I don't want to spoil it. It's such a good read. But I do think...
there's no, I don't know if there's much to spoil. The title kind of spoils it.
The Death of Ivan Illich. This is just a wonderful story. And so we'll just briefly talk about it.
Just to dive into it. I mean, I think what you were just describing, like you were saying, there's like the suffering, right? And the... having a sense of like the purpose of one's life, right? Like Ivan Illich, who's the main character of this story, because the title says that. He basically tries to live. His world is kind of this same world that Dostoevsky's critiquing, where the main thing that he's concerned about and that he's trying to accomplish in his life is to sort of establish himself in a secure, comfortable life.
Yeah, it's very, I mean, you don't have to look too far for what's going on. Tolstoy, at least in the translation that we're using by Ilmer Maud, Maud's translation emphasizes words like agreeable and decorous and simple, ordinary, harmless, yeah, pleasant, proper, performing your duty, being approved by society, etc. Desirable, just what's expected. So Ivan is living all his life conducting his family, conducting his business in such a way that it will be seen as proper in everybody else's eyes. And that's what he thinks the happiness will be. I'm performing my duty, but mm-hmm. I live by everybody else's expectations.
Right.
And what Morrison says about this is that he ends up not really living real life. Everything's vicarious.
Yeah.
When he finally gets the house he wants and starts like hosting the parties he wants mm-hmm. with all the well-to-do people, Tolstoy makes a comment that these houses look so great, but it's exactly like the neighbor's house. It's exactly like the neighbor's party. The exact same conversation, the exact same list of people are all showing up. His idea of happiness is to have the most homogenous upper middle class Russian life possible.
Right, right. The things that he's after in life are like the approval of society, like kind of the satisfaction in like wealth and just like a materially comfortable life, basically. So, and I think that thing that you're bringing up where it turns out that all of these things he's striving for turn out to be these things that they're kind of just like banal. They're exactly the same as everything else that the people around him are striving for. I think Morrison has this part where he sums that up really well. He says, as the end draws near, the more horrible it seems to Ivan Illich that he has lived each moment for gratification in the present, leaving no meaningful residue. It is as if his life had been lived by someone else or by no one in particular. To live for pleasure entails sacrificing one's unique soul. I just think that's a really effective sort of encapsulation of what's basically the overall effect of Ivan Illich's life is that it's like anybody could have lived that. It's like he's not even doing anything that's unique to himself. He's just running after these things that, you know, all the other materialistic people in his society are also running after.
The story actually begins with him already dying. It begins with looking at a series of vignettes, looking at people he knew. And then there's a flashback. It begins, the first chapter is the day of his funeral. And we follow one of his co-workers and we meet his wife and everything. But then we after the funeral is over, we jump back to his childhood and then fast forward through his early careers. And then it really slows down once he moves into his new house. Gets everything situated, and then begins developing a mysterious illness that all the doctors misdiagnose or give different diagnoses to. And then it really camps on the final years and weeks and days of his life. But yeah, at the beginning, with that very first scene, he's barely dead and already looking at who's going to replace him and how they're going to get promoted and how the office is going to get shuffled around.
Right, yeah.
His job is entirely interchangeable.
Yeah.
Or when he goes to the doctor, he starts realizing, well, he's a judge. Ivan Illich is a judge. And then when he goes to the doctor, he realizes that just as, like, every case is just another, it's just another criminal, just another defendant, just another person seeking parole or whatever. He's just another patient. He's just another medical mystery to solve.
Yeah.
And he feels like he's getting that exact same treatment. And he used to glory in how he compartmentalized, like, just the fundamentals of the case, not looking at the subjective elements of a case. Just like it was purely what he thought was purely objective. And now here's a doctor trying to diagnose him the exact same. I'm just looking at the objectives of the case. We're not going to talk about life and death. We're just going to talk about the kidney or the appendix or whatever the current theory is. So he begins to get a taste of his own medicine and sees how everything that he was living for fails him when he starts facing death.
Well, and it's like, it's particularly striking when, well, I don't, but some of this is like he actually realizes this is going on, but then in the beginning, he's already dead, but it's sort of following how these different people, like his coworker who knew him since he was a kid, and then like his wife and stuff, they're all sort of viewing his death as like, oh yeah, this is kind of annoying. Like,
yeah,
he died. Like, now we have to like go to his funeral. No, like, and they're not, you know, they're not saying any of this out loud, yeah, but that's like what they're thinking and feeling.
Yeah,
and they sort of have this same attitude towards life that he did, which is like, how can I just get on with pursuing my own kind of pleasant, stable life?
Yeah.
This is interrupting my routine.
Yeah.
I don't want to think about death. I don't want to think about how all of this, you know, pursuit of material security really might be meaningless. Like, I don't want to think about that.
Yeah. And it's
all these other people have that same mindset as he
did. It's always somebody else. It's never me that's going to die.
Right.
It takes him a long time to own the fact that he's dying. He's really terrified. And he thinks it's an injustice. I did everything right. I lived a perfectly good, it totally innocuous, but a perfectly good life. Why should I now be at such an early age, only in like his late 40s? Like, why should I be? Why should this be happening to me now?
Right. And so I think he really embodies this sort of like pursuit, quote unquote, pursuit of happiness, this kind of Epicurean lifestyle. Like, he just wants to be comfortable and live a pleasant life. And then when he's no longer able to do that because he's just physically suffering so much from this disease, then he kind of starts to think about, oh, what if I was wrong?
Yeah.
Barely, towards the very end of his life.
The ending is redemptive.
The last couple days.
Yeah, the ending is redemptive. He starts figuring things out.
Right, yeah. but the majority of his life is so comfortable. He's sort of, like, inoculated to taking any kind of serious thought about it because he's
sheltered himself so well. He's insulated himself. As soon as his wife starts becoming quarrelsome, he just spends more time at work.
Right.
And he tries to compartmentalize everything. And anything that's uncomfortable, he just tries to avoid.
Yeah.
So it takes a mystery illness that nobody can solve and facing death right in the face to really wake him up and realize that he really has wasted his only one life.
Yeah. And I think that's one thing that's really striking. There's a lot of really like kind of sad moments in this story that Tolstoy really makes you feel because he's Tolstoy, he's an amazing writer. But one of them that's particularly sad is just how he's surrounded by all these people who don't even want to acknowledge the fact that he's dying. And the word that's used in this translation is like falsity. And there's just this sense of fakeness of like everybody. They're all kind of going about their regular lives very decorously and with propriety. And are unwilling to just be honest about the fact that, yeah, Ivan Illich is dying and this is horrible. Like, they don't want to think about death. They just want to kind of keep going through the motions of their life. And I think that, to me, seems like, yeah, that's probably, that makes sense that's like a side effect of this kind of materialistic philosophy where it's like, yeah, I'm just living for what's going to make me happy. I don't want to be interfered with in that pursuit. And I'm just going to try to establish that securely in my life. It would make sense that you develop this kind of layer of falseness about like things like death or disease, right? It's like these things are like, I don't want to think about those. Like, I'm only focusing on, you know, what I can get and establish for myself and how I can make myself comfortable and secure. And
the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. So like, for example, a really telling part is he finally gets the job with the really good salary, and he moves to St. Petersburg ahead of his wife and kids, and he does all this work in the house. And for once, like, his wife and he are not grumbling, because they both want the same thing. Well, he wants it for work, and she wants it for being a socialite. But, like, having a tight ship of a house that they're doing hospitality, they're inviting wealthy, important people over. The house is beautiful. It's got great furniture and whatnot.
Right.
For once, they both have the same goal. And for the first few weeks, as long as they have, like, a new room to paint, a new thing to buy, a new party to arrange, new neighbors to meet, you name it. Once they have, as long as they have some kind of thing to do for that project, they're happy. But as soon as they settle into the new normal, they're no longer getting those little pings of happiness.
Yeah, right. Distractions.
Yeah, they're no longer getting those distractions. And so, it begins to fall apart really, really quickly. To wrap things up, this is one of my favorite texts ever. And I think the reason why is because even though it's set turn of the century-ish, Russia, different continent, different context, just a very different world from ours. It feels right. So shockingly, uncomfortably contemporary and even personal. I see a lot of myself in Ivan. I see a lot of our own culture in Ivan, that we're doing a bunch of things because they're the right thing to do, because you know, it's for the kids. We're giving our kids a good future, and so we're going to put them in the best schools and make sure there's always money on the table, food on the table, and money on the table.
Money in the bank.
Money in the bank. And meanwhile, we're poisoning ourselves with this contentment and this complacency, and just pursuing our own pleasure. This feels like a really honest, insightful commentary on the American dream. I don't even know if the American dream was fully crystallized even as an idea at the time that Tolstoy was writing this across the ocean.
Yeah.
But it really does feel like one of the best takedowns of the American dream I could imagine, at least particularly in fiction. This can easily be, it wouldn't be as nearly as interesting, but this can be easily be adapted as an American film set in the 50s or even in the present day. During some kind of time of some sort of boom prosperity. It feels like a thoroughly American story.
Right. And
or just generally Western.
Yeah, I think definitely, like, with the amount that the American dream has been identified with, like, pursuing wealth, establishing a secure life for yourself, a comfortable life for yourself, whatever. Like, that's exactly, like, that's almost exactly Ivan Ilyich's goal. I think there's a big element in his thought process, it's like he wants the sort of approval of society. He wants people to think of him really well. He wants to only associate with people who are looked at positively, who are wealthy, who are intelligent, et cetera, right? And so for him, a lot of it is like he's trying to conform his own, you know, standard of living to whatever is kind of the norm. That, to me, that strikes me as, like, maybe a little less individualistic than I usually think of the American dream as being. But I think
it's not just individual. Like, we don't just choose things just because. We choose things because we see other people doing them, and we think that other people approve of them. So I think, even though America says they're individualistic, that individualistic value is still very much, it's implicated in and complicit in a culture of peer pressure. A culture of acceptability.
Yeah, I definitely think that
it's paradoxical, of course, because I am showing that I'm one of you by being stubbornly bent on my individual will.
Yeah, right. So I definitely think that there's a shared, like, obsession with, like, I don't even know if it's, like, a wealthy life, just, like, kind of a secure, comfortable life. Which is exactly this kind of, like, pursuit of happiness that Morrison is essentially just, like, warning against. I think this story, like you're saying, it has a lot of ways that it's mirroring, like, the American dream. So I think it is highly relevant for us to think about. I think it's, maybe trying to, like, step back even a little bit from that and think about, okay, how does this sort of relate to our civic engagement and our,
That is the question we should end with.
Way that we're sort of relating to each other in society as Christians. But one thing that strikes me is that if you're trying to live a life from this perspective of, well, really all there is the material world, I really just am trying to secure happiness for myself. if you're just trying to do that and that's your ultimate goal in life, like you're not really going to be a good neighbor. I think that's one of the things that would follow from that.
You're not going to stick your neck out for other people.
Yeah, you might like maintain, you know, positive relationships with your people who are living around you and just kind of like have a general veneer of like, I don't know, harmony or something. But I think to really love our neighbors requires more than, requires us to sacrifice, I think, even our own pursuit of security and comfort a lot of the time. So I think just kind of on a general level of like the way that we approach life, it's actually this kind of thinking is going to prevent us from being as good neighbors as we could be, I think.
Yeah. And I think particularly if we think about as Christians, the best thing we can do for a neighbor is to share Christ with them, to proclaim the gospel to them. And obedience to Christ will involve picking up our crosses and following along the road to Calvary. If we're bent on our own comfort, we're not going to do that. We're going to dishonor and disobey God, and we're going to fail to love our neighbors in the ultimate way that we ought to, and that is pointing them to the greater hope that is Christ.
Hmm.
The trouble is that we are all covertly, even though we don't like to admit it and don't like to think about it, because we live and breathe materialism, because we live and breathe the American dream, whether we like to acknowledge it or not, that's just our frame of reference. We have a lot more materialism in us than we'd like to admit, and that's something we really need to struggle with. And it does hurt our Christian witness, though maybe in a more subtle way, because we think, oh, well, that's a good witness. If we're just like good citizens or, you know, good hardworking Americans, that's a good witness, right? Our affluence can be a sign that God has blessed us, which is a very prosperity, health, wealth, gospel way of looking at it. And yet, how many of us actually have believed that if we're successful in this life, that means that God has blessed us, and that means that people see that makes God look good.
Hmm.
The trouble is that people need to see in us a hope that is different. Otherwise, they won't see any hope at all.
Mm.
If we live for the exact same things, we just put a little bit of a Christian veneer on it. That's not going to be persuasive to anybody. That's not going to be compelling to anybody. What is different is a life of radical sacrifice and others' interest. And really going against the stream. It's a cultural pull that, you know, we can see in Turn of the Century Russia in a short story. We can see it in our own world, our own backyards, our own lives, our own homes. And it's a very strong tie, but we have to go against it.
Yeah, and I think there's lots of reasons to do that, some of which these other authors, Solzhenitsyn and Dostoevsky, are also highlighting, right? Like life can't actually be meaningful if that's all we pursue.
Right.
So there's a lot of reasons for us to like be wary of that mindset, I think. And these different writers are really helpful for that, I think.
So, right. I definitely would recommend people check
go
out
go read the Russians.
definitely read Tolstoy's story. It's a longish one. It took me a few afternoons to read, but this is really wonderful, and it really does show the power of fiction writing to just sort of act as a mirror to our souls and help us kind of reevaluate how we live and why we live that way.
It's a good note to end on. Yeah. And with that, I'm going to close this in prayer.
Yeah.
God, thank you for these authors and the conversation about happiness, about pursuing it and being wary of becoming obsessed with it. God, I pray that you would illuminate our understandings and move in our hearts, help us to ward off the desire for security and comfort and just material wealth above other things. I pray that you would deliver us from idolizing that, that you would help us learn from Ivan Illich, even though he's not even a real person, help us learn from Tolstoy's story and from these other authors talking about happiness, life is not to be found in pursuing happiness. It's to be found in pursuing you and in seeking to love our neighbors as ourselves, which often requires us to sacrifice our own happiness. So help us to see that path and follow it and continue to teach us to do that more so and more. Thanks for helping us with that. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Right. Well, thank you for joining us for this episode of In the Margin, and that'll be all. Signing out.